I had seen urban coyotes because I grew up in Los Angeles, and I had seen them on LA streets a lot. But I didn't fully understand how different they were until I got to graduate school. And one of my co-faculty advisors told me a story about a coyote in Chicago walking into a Quiznos in downtown. And I said, wait, hold up. A Chicago Quiznos coyote, I gotta see this. Right? Because I see coyotes on the street all the time in LA, but inside of a Quiznos establishment? Nah, that doesn't happen. You know, sure enough, that's exactly what happened.
Hi, welcome to Anthropomania. We're seeing a lot of wildlife in cities these days, and today we're talking about urban wildlife.
And not just the urban wildlife of today, but the urban wildlife of the future.
So at the top of the podcast, we heard scientist Dr. Chris Schell talking about coyotes. And while there was a thought of calling this episode Coyote Ugly,
wait,
I watched the trailer and no, we're not calling it
hard no.
Thanks for taking that bullet for us, Jay.
Yeah, it was.
I'm sorry you put yourself through that.
It was tough, actually. Now, back to Chris Schell. He pronounced it coyote. What about you guys? How do you pronounce the name of that animal and why?
I pronounce it as coyote, and that's because I grew up with my dad saying coyote, and I always actually kind of thought maybe that was wrong because we live in a more rural setting, but I'm going to keep saying it because those are my roots.
Yeah, and I'm...
So you're coyote?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I'm firmly in the coyote camp, and I think part of that is influenced by the cartoon Wile E. Coyote.
My dad did cheer for the coyote always in those cartoons, I should tell you, Erica.
Or the coyote, you mean.
Or the coyote.
So I'm going to go all nerdy on you guys and say, you know what? The word originated in the language spoken as far back in Central America by the Aztecs, the language called Nahuatl. And the word in Nahuatl, and I'm going on the internet for this pronunciation, is...
It must be right.
You got to listen carefully. Coyote. So what's actually weird about this is that my mother pronounced it, and we were living in Winnipeg, where I never saw a coyote. She pronounced it coyote. So I think she was channeling Nahuatl. I'm not really sure why.
She may have been, but, you know, the pronunciation of coyote or coyote, it's a regional thing. You know, someone actually did a survey on this in the United States, and it turns out that the three-syllable coyote is more popular on the coasts and in the south and southwest. But once you get to the plains, then you get that two-syllable coyote. So maybe that pronunciation crawled up towards you, Nikki.
Yeah, I'm sort of right on the cusp of those ecosystems. So, but we're talking a lot about coyotes here, and those are not the only urban wildlife. So sure, you might see a coyote once in a while in your city or your town, but the few minutes you see them is really just a snapshot in time. For the other 23 hours and 55 minutes, that coyote has a whole life, and in the city, they are part of a thriving, pulsating urban underworld that many people are just not even aware of. Which is why today I'm going to take you on a tour of a city that I've created based on the research. Imagine that as you lay your head to sleep, the bats roosting on the tree behind your apartment are just waking up to feed on the night insects. As they flitter across the city landscape, they experience the cool air coming off urban ponds or, you know, your residential lawns. They're also blasted by the heat still coming off the sun-soaked pavement from the day. They fly by a street lamp where a spider's hanging in its web. That spider's a bit bigger than the same species in the country because it's a city spider. And you know, that spider might be someone's breakfast tomorrow when a crow alights on that street lamp because it's, you know, circle of life. As the bats fly over a coulee or a valley in the city, they might see a white-tailed deer. And foxes might weave in and out of the trees of city parks while they hunt for cottontails. Entire dramas are unfolding here. predators are eviscerating their prey on school fields. Raccoons are scrapping with domestic cats. And, you know, quietly over in some corner, an ant colony has slowly evolved to tolerate those high city heats of that urban tarmac, and they are thriving. This stuff is going on all over the world in cities. I don't know. Have you guys had any encounters?
I don't actually have an encounter that quite matches that magical world you put forward. My encounter was actually on the dirty streets of the downtown Vancouver Bar District. But that's the thing, is that wildlife is still there. It was in my youth, when I was in my 20s. It was early in the morning. The bars had closed. Everyone was on the street. And in the corner of my eye, I saw this coyote just amongst a huge group of people kind of scrounging around for some leftover pizza that someone dropped. And the thing that really resonated with me at those early hours in the morning was just how close it was to so many humans, and more importantly, how it really wasn't bothered by it whatsoever.
Yeah, they don't care much, right? They've got like no F's to give about people and when they're really used to them.
They're like, where's my pizza?
Yeah, well, this...
Give it up.
Yeah, exactly.
What about you, Nikki? You must have such experiences in Jasper.
I've had several of those experiences, as you can imagine, living in a town that's sort of surrounded by national park. So we live in these condos right along this creek. And last summer, my neighbor Sally left her back door open and a pine marten ran in and went up on her kitchen counters. And then it crapped on the bananas because, you know, they like to defecate on the highest point they can. And just imagine, like, it's got this really cute face. Like, they're kind of these long, skinny animals about the size of a loaf of bread. Which is ironic because it actually took a loaf of bread from her countertop and ran it out the back door. And where she found it, it tried to pull it through the fence and the bread was too fat. So the loaf of bread was just like jammed in the fence.
Oh, no.
I mean, I'm laughing. I didn't have to clean crap off bananas. Sorry, Sally.
No, exactly. But, you know, these stories are typical, right? We're hearing a lot more of them, perhaps because of the pandemic. But one of the questions that we want to address here and now is, is this something that's increasing? Like, if we go back 40 or 50 years, did people see many fewer raccoons, coyotes, pigeons, maybe even owls in the city? And, you know, I did a search and it's really hard to find. And I think one of the reasons is scientists have only started seriously looking at urban wildlife in the last, say, 30 years. And so it's very difficult to know whether what we're seeing is actually a trend. Although I think as we go on today, we're going to discover that, yeah, it is, that this is a real thing. It's a scientific thing and it's growing.
We're living in a pandemic right now, and that has kind of intensified our interest in urban wildlife. Birding, for example, has exploded over the past year. One app that people use to record birds, it reported an increase of 102% over the past year and 8,500 unique recordings of bird sightings on Easter weekend alone. That's a lot, guys.
I think people are becoming a lot more aware of what's right outside their door. And today, we'll be talking about what people see a lot in North America. But we are aware that there are Anthropomania listeners around the world. We see you, Australia, and we want to hear from you about your urban wildlife experiences. Like, did you see a kangaroo in the mall on Boxing Day? Because if you did, you need to tell us. So I'll see you on the Twitters, Aussies.
Looking at the wildlife in our cities, there may be a lot of different types of species in cities, but not all species is well-equipped to live in these urban environments. It takes a certain amount of toughness to live in the mean streets of a city. It takes a certain type of animal. And one of the best examples of an animal that's adapted really well to an urban environment is the coyote.
Do you mean coyote?
I mean...
She means coyote.
but truly, you know, these coyotes are generalists that have really adapted so well to an urban environment. And urban coyotes, well, that is Chris Schell's specialty.
My name is Dr. Christopher J. Schell. Most people just call me Chris. I'm an assistant professor at the University of California, Berkeley. One thing we know, coyotes are super, super flexible. And their ability to survive in an array of environments is what makes them so adaptable to cities. But whether or not that change was already built in them, say dealing with, I don't know, wolves and mountain lions and bears in non-urban environments, you kind of already got to be pretty flexible. But many of my colleagues have seen that there are genetic changes.
This genetic change that Chris is talking about is a little bit tricky, right? Because if you want to know that animals are actually evolving uniquely in urban settings as opposed to rural settings, there got to be genetic changes that underlie that. But you can still have random genetic changes that aren't really being forced by the urban environment. They're just random genetic changes that would have happened to them anyway. So that's a little bit of evidence that maybe evolution is happening, but it's not yet convincing.
One of the ways they figure out if it's just random is they compare the same species that lives in the city and also lives in the country. And this is what happened in some research on this yellow-flowered plant called hawksbeard. Hawksbeard has moved into cities in places like Montpellier in France. And what they're finding is it's sort of eking out an existence in these tiny little patches of soil, you know, sometimes near trees. Now, in the wild, it has two strategies for disseminating its seeds. So it will either drop heavy ones and that land nearby and create more plants close by, or it will send big fluffy white ones out on the wind to colonize, you know, further afield. And what they're finding in the city when compared to the country plants is the plants in the city have started to drop more heavy seeds because there's no point in producing a fluffy seed that's just going to blow away and land on the concrete. So it's not just coyotes. We're seeing this flexibility in a lot of other species like plants.
And it's so cool how you can see such significant changes in cities. And we spoke a bit earlier about how the pandemic is really forcing us to go outside and see the wildlife right outside our door. But that view, it's not the same for everyone, even within the same city. Where we find our urban wildlife, diverse urban wildlife, can tell us not only about our cities, but ourselves.
The way in which we treat urban wildlife is sort of a reflection of how we treat each other. And I'll give you the example of thinking about walking on a singular street inside of a city. Pick any city, it doesn't really matter. I'm from LA, so let's think Sunset Boulevard, right? If you're walking down Sunset, depending on where you are on Sunset, you will see more concrete relative to, say, further down in the more expensive areas, greater tree canopy cover, greater vegetation cover. You may also notice something like, oh, snap, it's a little cooler in this area that has greater vegetation. That affects where you start to see positive relationships between wealth, so socioeconomic wealth, and tree cover has a name. It's called the luxury effect. So society, through a bunch of processes, generates these inequalities in who has the access to green space and where that green space is located.
That just makes me feel sad because we know green spaces are so important to human health. And you can imagine that paying to water and doing all these things it takes to maintain many urban plants is just out of reach for a lot of communities.
There's also pretty good evidence that as you penetrate into the city from the suburbs, you get more and more concrete. You get a smaller and smaller variety of species. What he's saying is exactly true. Call it the luxury effect, but that's the way most cities are actually built.
Regardless, coyotes can really survive anywhere. They can survive in concrete areas. They can survive in green spaces. And because we're seeing them so often, we're also seeing a lot more human-coyote conflict. And one of the biggest issues in urban environments is that these city coyotes are becoming more aggressive and they're becoming more tolerant to humans too. And that scares some people. But, you know, what do? Do we kick them out of our cities? No, it's not that easy. Because coyotes, love them or hate them, they actually provide a major service to urban ecosystems.
The public discourse about whether or not these animals are becoming more aggressive or they're dominating, say, these urban landscapes in a way that is threatening to people, in some instances, is sort of misleading because there are certain individuals that you can count on, you know, your two hands, but they create so much buzz because if there's one bite on one person, the entire city is on alert. Good example. Right now, as we're recording this podcast, there is a coyote in the East Bay that has bitten 5 people in under 3 months. So that one individual will probably get into the psyche of the entire town, and everybody will start to think coyotes are super dangerous. When in reality, that one individual may be one of 200, 300 animals. So the other individual animals in that population, they're going about their business, avoiding people, watching them, but really not wanting to be around them at all. It's those few examples that we latch on to. So are they becoming more habituated? Sure. They're becoming more habituated, more tolerant of people. And that's for a whole host of reasons. Things like feeding wildlife, PSA, right? Daily PSA for y'all. Don't feed wildlife. It may be, say, new species interactions. So we know that there are a propensity of outdoor cats all throughout California and many other states. Second PSA, keep your cat indoors for a whole bunch of reasons. The biggest being cats threaten a lot of biodiversity for rodents, birds, and the like. So coyotes provide a service by taking out those cats, but a lot of people don't like that. So the way in which we perceive the animals generates more of this big bad wolf effect, right? We think of them to be dangerous in these systems, and yet they are perhaps the heroes, maybe that some folks don't want, but the ones that we need, right? There's a Batman drop right there for you. So we need them. They are our ecosystem sentinels.
Oh, that Batman quote is so good. And it's actually a really good comparison too. Batman, he was too aloof, too abrasive to be a hero, but he was the silent protector of Gotham. And coyotes are very much the same in urban environments. You know, they're generalists. They'll eat anything. And because of that, they're actually very, very effective pest control systems for our urban environments. It's not just feral cats. Coyotes can take care of voles. Coyotes can take care of invasive eastern cottontails. Coyotes can take care of anything. And that's why they're so important for the management of our urban ecosystems.
And I guess if we want coyotes to play that role, then we might have to think about how we adapt our own behavior, because there are some dangerous interactions with coyotes that have pretty serious consequences, you know, that sometimes involve small children, for example. And it's not just the biting. Coyotes carry disease. There's this really interesting long-term study that's been going on here in Edmonton, Alberta, and it's a long-term urban coyote study. And what they found is that there's a very high prevalence of a parasite called Echinococcus in the Edmonton coyote population. It's way higher than the natural population. It's well over 50%. And it's a tapeworm that humans are susceptible to. So imagine someone takes their dog to the dog park and a coyote's been in there the night before and it's kind of pooped all over the lawn, and the dog goes for a roll in it. You know, dogs love to roll in smelly stuff. Later that night, that person's, you know, watching Netflix, eating popcorn and petting their dog at the same time. In go the Echinococcus eggs. You know, it's rare so far, but 17 people in Alberta actually have contracted this disease, and it can be fatal.
Wow, I didn't know that.
You know, they perform ecosystem services, but as Nikki has just said, they can pose a risk too. So it's complicated.
You have to ask the question, you know, what does the future hold for coyotes? Could we envision a very different coyote population 100 years from now?
That's a really good question. I don't know if I see coyotes evolving, say, maybe specializations in different parts of the country. But it's certainly possible.
There's actually people out there that are trying to crossbreed coyotes with dogs to create a new, very temperamental type of animal called a coy dog. Essentially, they're trying to domesticate them. But is that really a good idea?
So whether or not coyotes are going to become domesticated is going to depend in large part on human beings' perceptions of the animals and whether or not those animals ever have a function in society beyond those ecosystem services we talked about earlier. So dogs and wolves, they're a really good example of kind of the exception to the rule, because you could have a lot of habituation. It should be noted, right? Raccoons are pretty habituated. Certain species of birds are pretty habituated, but we wouldn't necessarily say that they are domesticated. There would need to be some very intentional selection of specific behavioral phenotypes and controlled breeding of certain populations for it to qualify as domestication. But is it possible? I mean, y'all remember a year ago, everybody was watching Tiger King. Yeah, it's possible. Like, people do some crazy stuff. It's possible.
It's not a good idea to domesticate a coyote, and it is not a good idea to habituate them either.
What's the difference between habituation and domestication?
Well, domestication, as he said, is something that has to be kind of planned and controlled, and it takes place over a really long time. But habituation is wild animals who are still very wild figuring out how to live around people because it benefits them somehow. For example, before we had fenced school fields in Jasper, so I'm talking about when I grew up on the mean streets of Jasper, elk would come into town onto the school fields, both for the rut and to drop their calves and that kind of thing. And they're especially dangerous during those times. And it benefited them to work it out to be around people because it gave them refuge from the wolves, who are a little more wary of people, don't want to come into town. So there was little Nikki, you know, running to school, dodging elk during the rut. And, you know, it was not uncommon for a parent to say, if it gets bad, look for a parked car and just roll underneath it.
Even in the heart of cities, there are all kinds of animals that are still wild, like you wouldn't pet them, you don't breed them, but they're so common that we sometimes forget. So, you know, there's rats, there's mice, there's all kinds of plants, but the one that everybody is familiar with is the city pigeon. You know, they used to be a rural species, the rock dove, but they've adapted to cities because cities provide buildings that they can roost on. Cities provide tons of food, often garbage, but often, you know, people that shuffle off to the park and scatter seeds on the ground and the pigeons feed on them. So that is a perfect example of an urban wildlife species. And it's one that we've all seen. Now, the question is, could coyotes or other animals that at the moment aren't nearly as well adapted to the city, could they become in the future as common as pigeons? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. You mentioned garbage too, Jay, and we cannot talk about urban wildlife and garbage without talking about our neighborhood trash panda, the raccoon. They're everywhere, especially in a city like Toronto. There's over 100,000 raccoons in the city. That is enough to fill Madison Square Garden five times over. I have a story about a raccoon, but mine has to do with me carrying a bag of groceries home. I put the groceries down for a second, and before I knew it, this little mask-wearing, tiny-handed raccoon had plucked a bag of Doritos outside of my bag, scampered away like only 50 feet, opens up the bag with those tiny leather-gloved hands, and just starts shoving them into his mouth, maintaining eye contact with me the entire time. It was intense.
Orange dust flying all over his mouth.
Yeah, just it's a big f*** you.
It's very interesting to see how they adapt. Like, I have a place in the woods north of Toronto, about 150 kilometers north. And up until 2 years ago, and I've had it for like 20 years, I'd only seen raccoons once deep in the forest, a mother with three babies. Never, ever saw them around the cottage itself. Now, if you have a barbecue, you can guarantee that within an hour after you've shut it down, the raccoons will be on the deck. So this used to irritate me because they stole the bird seed I put in the feeder too. So one day I took a broom. I'm doing what Chris Schell says you actually shouldn't do. I opened the sliding door. The raccoons, like, they don't even care, right? They just turn around, turn their big fat bodies around and start waddling off to the edge of the deck so they can, you know, go down the post to the ground. And so I crept up behind one. I just gave him a little tap on the butt. And instead of accelerating to get away from me, raccoon turned around, snarled at me, and just looked me in the eye. And I thought, oh, okay, you're becoming an urban raccoon. And I don't like that.
He was like, blink, Ingram, blink.
Yeah, try me.
But, you know, raccoons are cool, right? Because as urban wildlife, they adapt as well, maybe even better than coyotes. Mm. And one of the key questions is that sort of an array of behaviors that they already had? They're really flexible, really adaptable. That enables them to work into the city. Or, because they've been in cities for so long now, are they starting to change genetically? You know, our old friend Suzanne McDonald has been studying the behavior of urban raccoons. She's a psychologist and biologist at York University. And she noted how city raccoons do not cross the big thoroughfares in Toronto, the main streets. Now, maybe they've learned to do that, but maybe they're evolving to be a different kind of raccoon. So she set out to gather some hard data on city raccoons versus their country cousins. She can't quite conclude too much yet because she needs more animals to study. But what she's seen so far is pretty tantalizing.
Well, this is a really long, drawn-out study, which I did not expect to be lasting as long as it has. But it was originally started because I noticed by putting GPS collars on urban raccoons that they'd never crossed major roads in the city of Toronto, which was really interesting to me because if they do cross major roads, they actually get hit by cars and then they don't reproduce. So it struck me that maybe raccoons are learning not to cross major roads and they're having smart babies that learn not to cross major roads. And isn't that interesting? Because that suggests that there's cognitive evolution going on, that these raccoons in the city are getting smarter. So I have these bitey little raccoons that grow up together in the same environment, but have not had experience foraging and have not had experience going out in urban areas with their mothers or rural areas with their mothers. Urban animals, they're much more persistent and they try more strategies. So they give it a go. And if one way doesn't work, they try another way. Whereas the rural animals, they would give it a go and then it didn't work and then they would just leave. And that, I think, that was pretty striking, that the urban ones would work at these problems for hours. One of the animals that I observed, she worked on it for 6 hours before she got in. You never see that in a rural animal. Again, they have different energy requirements. They're at the edge of starvation in rural areas often, and so they need to move on. They can't just invest that much time. There's a difference in this tendency to approach new objects, which we call neophilia, if you like new objects, and neophobia, if you don't like new objects. And so it looks to me like the urban ones are neophilic and the rural ones are neophobic, which makes sense. If you live in the country, don't approach new things because they might kill you. Those kinds of traits are the ones that could be selected for through evolution.
Suzanne got the go-ahead from friends to set up a big garbage bin in their backyard with food inside, but the lid secured by a bungee cord. She then turned on a wildlife camera and waited.
I would leave it at night and then come back the next day. And they called and they said, oh, well, I don't think anybody came last night because the garbage can is intact. And I said, oh, well, I'll come and pick it up. So I went and then I looked inside and the food, which is cat food, was gone. I was like, well, this is interesting. So we looked at the camera, the video footage, and that female, she tried and tried and tried to get in. And eventually she opened up the garbage can, just the lid, just a little bit. And she slid her giant body in the garbage can, got the food, and then got out again and left it completely standing like it never been touched. It was awesome.
Persistence. Persistence. You slide your giant body in a little crack between the lid and the top of the can.
Yeah. Like, is there some point at which they're so fat they just can't operate anymore?
And they get stuck and their little butts are just hanging out of the garbage can.
They're just stuck in the garbage can.
And we all feel sorry for them. So the question, at least from the scientific point of view, is this difference in behavior that Suzanne is seeing, is it just the experience of urban raccoons? They know they can be more persistent because they're safer, or are they actually evolving? And until she can look at a lot more baby raccoons, both from rural and urban areas, she can't be sure yet. But it sure is interesting.
it's not just big things like raccoons, coyotes, birds that are changing in response to urban environments and the garbage that is plentiful there. There's tiny things too that are also changing in cities. For example, something like a tiny mosquito.
My name's Mark Johnson. I'm an associate professor of biology at the University of Toronto, Mississauga, and the director of the Center for Urban Environments. So the Culex pipiens is, the common name is the northern house mosquito. And this is a very common mosquito that occurs in a number of places throughout the world. Very common in Europe, very common in North America, for example. Known to carry some diseases that are relevant to humans. But what's interesting about it is typically this mosquito lives above ground and will breed in small little ponds or small little pools, and it needs a blood meal in order to produce eggs, which it'll often get from humans, or it may get it from a mammal or some other organism. Well, what they've discovered is that during World War II, when people in London, England, during bombing raids, they'd have to go underground to be safe. And so they would often congregate into these underground tunnels, and they were getting ravaged by mosquitoes. And it was this northern house mosquito, and people followed up and discovered that this is the northern house mosquito, but it's a completely novel form that they named a new variety, Culex pipiens molestus, because it was attacking people so vigorously in these underground environments. And with further examination, what they discovered was that this organism is living underground, and while it will take a blood meal, it doesn't require a blood meal in order to produce eggs. And it exclusively lives in these underground habitats. Maybe it sometimes feeds on rats, but it doesn't have to. And that it has become, through time, genetically diverged from the above ground form into this novel below ground form. And they've now rediscovered that this species also occurs in underground habitats in New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, and a number of other places.
So if we have that example of the mosquito that has become two different kinds of mosquito, what are we going to see in the future? Are we going to see a set of wildlife in the city that really is composed of different species, like urban species that don't even exist right now?
In 100 years, that's unlikely to expect that we'll have many completely novel species. Very unlikely. But there may be some that don't recognize those rural forms as their own species. That example of the mosquito, that underground form, when you put it in a cage with the above ground form, doesn't recognize it as its own species. It won't mate with it. Will that type of thing happen in more organisms? It might. Will more organisms evolve to be adapted to living in urban environments? Almost certainly. And we already see that happening.
Yeah, and almost certainly, potentially, because by 2050, over two-thirds of the human population on Earth will live in cities. Some people say that's, you know, a conservative estimate. So cities are going to grow. And with that growth, more opportunities for urban wildlife.
That is almost influencing the way that we design our future cities. It's going to become more and more important to accommodate not only the people living in them, but the animals living in these cities as well. Chris Schell told me that in cities, ecosystem integrity allows for greater biodiversity, and that allows for greater environmental health for everyone.
And, you know, maybe part of the considerations for that design is not just making it easy for generalists like coyotes and pigeons, but also building in features that allow the greatest amount of biodiversity. So for animals that have a harder time, potentially we give them some habitat to really increase the diversity that's there.
Another trend is that invasive, non-native species do better in cities than in the countryside. That makes sense. As you move toward the center from the suburbs, you get more and more of them, non-native species. At the same time, you've got a more unnatural environment, paved surfaces, heat island, different soils, human population density. And because we're talking about invasive species, they can go everywhere. So this is not just a one city, one country trend. It's a global trend. And native species, which aren't as adaptable, are going to be relegated to that part of nature that remains outside those cities.
this is where it might be up to people who live in cities and, you know, bigger towns and everywhere, quite frankly, to try and fight the good fight to keep a lot of native species around. You know, there are places where they're planting entire boulevards with good plants for pollinators, or people that are leaving their lawns behind for, you know, more diverse landscapes that promote better habitat for different birds and insects. So I think it's important we're all on board to try and fight that from happening, Jay.
Yeah, and you know, those fights can start really small. A golf course. Let's change it from a golf course to a habitat. I mean, that's one way you could do it. But people are going to have to understand or come to believe that exposure to nature is a really great thing to have. I mean, I don't know what you guys think, but I think the next few decades, two or three, maybe four decades, are going to be really crucial to try and interrupt some of those trends that I mentioned. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. It feels like things are kind of changing exponentially.
Brisbane, Australia is a great example. It's kind of served as a pilot city where they're designing the city in a way that is more friendly to wildlife. That's all it takes. Every marathon starts with a first step, and Brisbane is an example of that first step. So maybe what we see in the next 100 years in Brisbane will build up some more momentum that will extend to the rest of the world.
We could see really great situations in the future, but I bet there'll be a lot of species in urban centers that we don't actually have right now, that they will have arisen because of the urbanization of the world. Anyway.
That sounds like your next book, Jay. Is it going to be science fiction? Is that what you're doing?
Dystopian futures with Jay Ingram.
No, you know, the next step here is that we're going to ask our listeners to tweet us with their version of how they say coyote. Coyotes or coyote. So everybody.
Hey, Team Coyote, I'm waiting.
It'll be really interesting. We'll see. Maybe we can even, if people would tweet us, say how they pronounce it and tell us where they live, roughly, right? We will get to get a version of our own survey that Erica mentioned earlier.
Well, that's it for Anthropomania today. Always fun digging around in the dirt with you, Jay, and you, Erica.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Always nice to speculate wildly with you guys.
Speaking of dirt, I'm still disappointed we didn't call it Coyote Ugly.
You need to let that go, Jay.
Also, big thanks to today's guests, Chris Schell, Suzanne McDonald, Mark Johnson, and a shout out to Colleen Cassidy St. Clair at the University of Alberta, studies urban coyotes, and she was a great resource for us. If you like today's episode, please follow us on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss anything. We appreciate it if you leave us a positive review. There's also a listener survey in our show notes, and we adore your feedback.
The Anthropomania conversation continues over on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, so join us and tag us with your coyote pronunciation, or coyote, or whatever you want to do, and your memorable urban wildlife encounters.
Australia, don't let us down. You can also find the entire episode on YouTube. Search Anthropomania to find it. And for even more Anthropomania content, we got you covered over on our blog, anthropomania.com. There you can sign up for our weekly newsletter. Find a ton of other great content, including articles from the Anthropomania team. Now, the Anthropomaniacs, all of us, are going to be taking a short break to recharge and put together more episodes before we launch season two. But we guarantee we'll be back with the same great content.
So from all of us here at Anthropomania, be well, and please let the wildlife speak for itself. I'm Nikki Wilson.
I'm Erica Seerin.
I'm Jay Ingram. Bye for now.